Many people in our food community have been seriously impacted by Superstorm Sandy, and our hearts go out to them. At HRN, we've been covering these stories since the storm hit. To learn more, visit our website at www.heritageradionetwork.org. The following program has been brought to you by Rolling Press, a family-run, eco-friendly printing company. For more information, visit rollingpress.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, I'm Linda Palacio, host of A Taste of the Past. And Thanksgiving has long held a tradition of preparing and giving food to the needy here in America. And now, here in New York, more than ever, there are so many people, so many families affected by Hurricane Sandy. And I want to share with you an organization that is putting out a special effort to help those families in need. It's called FamilyToFamily.org. It's an organization to share your bounty, and it helps people all over the country and internationally, but they are putting out a special effort at this time to help those victims of Hurricane Sandy in New York, and especially now at Thanksgiving time, where people, we all tend to think about people in need. We sit down to our bountiful tables and think about those in need, and there are things that you can do to help for Thanksgiving and all time. It's family-to-family.org, family-to-family.org. It provides many different options to help, straight donations, volunteer work, cooking meals, and you can particularly donate at this time to cook meals for 10 or donate money to buy meals for 10 to 14 people for Thanksgiving dinner. You can also sponsor a family. Not individually, you could do it individually, but they usually put together a couple different sponsors, a couple different donors with a family. And you follow that family through the next few difficult months, and you're in touch with them by mail or however else, and asking, what do you need? And they can give you a list of things that they need. And through this effort, you can really have an impact on their lives and help them with things in particular that they need. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention. I know here on the network we have been highlighting so many different opportunities to help, and there are many. And I just thought I would bring this one to your attention as well, FamilyToFamily.org. And today, on A Taste of the Past, we'll be talking all about Thanksgiving. Stay tuned. Thanksgiving, indeed. It's a holiday that is very special to many, many Americans because we think of it as the traditional American holiday. And it's a holiday that we think of, too, as just celebrating family and what we have, and a non-religious holiday, not always the case. But it is indeed a holiday that is special to so many people. And today I'm going to talk with somebody who is an expert, I'd like to say, in all things Thanksgiving. She is Sandy Oliver. And Sandy is a food historian, a food writer. She's an authority on colonial through modern American food history. She's a producer and advocate of sustainable food and cookery in New England, and the award-winning author of Saltwater Foodways, and for many years was the publisher and writer for Food History News, and is co-author of a book several years ago called Giving Thanks, through her work with Plymouth Plantation, and it is a history, including recipes, of early Thanksgiving. Welcome, Sandy.
Thank you so much.
You know, I said that it is a holiday that we think of as being a truly American holiday and a non-religious holiday. But Thanksgivings, certain types of Thanksgivings, were very much English holidays in the past. Is that so?
Yes, that's right.
And certainly
the
religious.
English has their traditional harvest festivals at the end of the growing season. Our Thanksgiving is descended from that branch of festival family, with a little, since it was the Pilgrims, the earliest settlers New England, who established the holiday. There was, at that time, a religious aspect of the holiday. They went to meeting, listened to a few sermons, and then had a big dinner.
Mm. And it's interesting, and I did a show a few years ago, and I think I basically paraphrased the first two paragraphs of your book for my show, because the history is so concise and so clear. That you give the account of, very much so, this religious, where they went to meetings all day, you know, like their religious meeting all day long. And it is actually more so than what people realize. It's a relatively new holiday, hasn't been celebrated since actually 1621, although in different parts it was a New England tradition that became an American holiday. Why don't you tell us a little bit about those roots of Thanksgiving?
Sure. Do you want to talk about the big T Thanksgiving or the little T Thanksgivings? We have some of each. It was the custom in the past to declare Thanksgivings to show gratitude for almost anything that went well. You could have a Thanksgiving with a small T to give thanks for a rainfall after a drought. You could the end of a pestilence. The end of a war or a success in a battle or anything that the governor of a given locality felt was worth observing and expressing some gratitude for. Our big T Thanksgiving, however, the one that was always held in the fall, always held in New England at least sometime in November or early December, that Thanksgiving has really long, very persistent roots in New England anyway. And anywhere that New Englanders settled, even as they moved west, they took the holiday with them and began to observe it in their new locations. Some states in New England, particularly Connecticut, have a really durable history of it, a very solid observance of the Big T Thanksgiving, right from all through the 1700s, all through the 1800s, and into the 1900s.
So it really did not become a national holiday until much later.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, this was always declared by a state governor. In each state, got to pick the date they wanted to observe it on. They sent out the proclamation. They were usually read aloud in churches in various towns. If you want to believe everything that's written about the holiday, the little kids knew this was coming sometime soon. And they'd sit on the edge of their seats when they heard that they saw a big roll of parchment being unrolled and the proclamation read aloud to church, and they knew, you know, it wouldn't be too long with some mincemeat in the offing and a celebration. So it was, but it had to be declared state by state by state, and in order to make it a national holiday, we needed the federal government to get involved. We needed the president to get involved.
Mm-hmm. And so then we owe that to a writer and editor years ago, Sarah Josepha Hale. I think she was the one who she lobbied the president, Abraham Lincoln.
She lobbied everybody, and finally Lincoln. She started in 1847 on that. She's an interesting character. She was really the Martha Stewart of the 19th century in America, I think. She was the editor of Godey's Lady's Book,
right.
Very aware of style and refinement and gentility, and vigorously pursued it. She felt that a national holiday like this would tend to unite a country which was clearly falling apart.
Well, certainly around, 1847, indeed, Civil War time.
47, right. All through the 50s and into the early 60s. It really, and then of course, Lincoln finally picks a late November date and declares it a national holiday. But, of course, not everybody in the nation, I guess the Southerners certainly wouldn't have said they were in the nation at that point. They had formed the Confederacy by that time. But, you know, the Union was inclined to observe Thanksgiving.
Well, a feast actually did take place. There is some record of a harvest feast taking place in 1621, which is, you know, what everyone pictures, the pilgrims and the Indians sitting down to the table together. But indeed, there was some record of a feast that took place during that time.
Yes. Yes, Kathleen, my co-author, and I like to refer to that as the event of 1621. The people who ate it, the settlers who sat down with the Native Americans to eat that day, didn't call that Thanksgiving. Certainly not capital T Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
The assignment of that name to that event didn't happen until much later. But there was, in fact, an event, and there is one description of it provided for us, which you know is a very slender reed indeed on which to hang this the whole way to this holiday. But it took Edward Winslow to write a letter to a friend of his in England, and that's the famous eyewitness account, the one we have got.
And that even didn't come to light until a couple hundred years or 100 years
later.
Yeah,
a little bit later. Yeah, that's
right. Interesting. Well, it makes for a good story and certainly good images, and those have held true. But during those early Thanksgiving celebrations, as you say, even though they were spotty, and certainly New England celebrations, what was likely to have been on the table in those early, some of the recipes would have been on the table? We would not have necessarily seen what we see today, the stuffed turkey, right?
Not necessarily at all. You know, Thanksgiving was primarily a feast. So what we see on the table is festival foods. And because everybody was eating locally and seasonally in those days, thing is not local,
right,
or not seasonal. The core Thanksgiving meal is a New England autumn meal. Of course, you could have almost any kind of meat at the table, and if it was a big enough occasion and you had enough people there, then there probably was all kinds of meat. But we can figure on some kind of wild fowl. We can consider pork. People in New England, I suspect New Englanders like to have their Thanksgiving after they got their butchering done.
Mm-hmm.
So you might very well have had some fresh pork on the table, maybe beef. After all, you need suet for the puddings and the mincemeat that accompany this meal. We'd have autumn vegetables like squashes, turnips, and once we have potatoes in New England, which is really not until, let's see, they were introduced in the 1740s, we're not going to see very many potatoes. Certainly sauces, very likely cranberries made into a sauce to accompany, a sharp sauce to accompany whatever fowl was served. Our pumpkin, and apples and pies, mincemeat pie, plum pudding, festival food.
Well, and pies. I mean, certainly pies. You say pies, and pies have always been a big part of Thanksgiving. You recently wrote, in fact, in just the most recent edition of Savour magazine, you did a wonderful piece on the traditional pumpkin pie. And
yes, our American pie.
Yes, indeed. But but I wanted to talk about mincemeat. Mincemeat has kind of fallen out of favor, but mincemeat was something that was very much a part of the fall table, correct? And
mm-hmm.
And explain a little bit about that. About the background of mincemeat?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Most of us don't recognize mincemeat for the preserve that it is. It is a way of preserving meat along with apples and other kinds of fruits. It's spiced. It's also a convenience food, or was. When butchering was completed, you took sort of all the scrag ends of things and perhaps the tongue of a beef animal, together with bits and pieces and certainly suet, cooked it, chopped it all up, mixed it with apples, raisins or currants, citrus peel if you had some, spiced it, added cider, which was not always sweet cider.
Right.
And brandy if you had it, and you cooked it all up and then packed it into a crock where it would keep really rather well And you could just make up a pot any old time you wanted one. You just had to throw together a crust. And I have a feeling that, you know, women cooks in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries could do this sort of thing with you know, blindfolds on one hand tied behind their back. But, you know, just throw together a crust and then scoop out the required amount to fill the pie and bake it up, and there you go. A wonderful, rich filling. Again, often associated with the holidays. Mincemeat, at least in the English tradition, was always part of Christmas. And, of course, in New England, the earliest settlers, the Calvinists, chose not to celebrate Christmas. They associated it a little too strongly with Catholics, and so they refused to celebrate the holiday. And anybody making mincemeat right around the 24th of December, so was strongly suspected of observing Christmas holiday. So, you know, I mean, it's one thing to do to go without having Christmas, but it's a whole other thing to go without having any mincemeat. So we just take our mincemeat and we slide it over and slam it up against Thanksgiving. That way we get our mincemeat and, you know, a celebration too. So that's why I think we're eating mincemeat on Thanksgiving.
Well, and
of course,
but
that pathetic stuff we have today that
I was going
to that bears no resemblance whatsoever to the original article.
That's what I wanted. That's what I wanted to mention is how mincemeat has evolved or devolved or into
devolved. It's gone to all heck in a basket, I would say.
I mean, it's
I
just
know
a bunch
anybody,
of.
Very many of your listeners have ever had the real thing. The real thing is extraordinary. It's rich and unbelievably flavorful. I always use mincemeat as an argument against this. Oh, well, you know, Yankee cooking is so bland. Well, you know, you get a mouthful of, honest to God, mincemeat, and there's nothing bland about it.
Ugh, sounds wonderful.
It was, as the 19th century wore on, there was less and less and less meat all the time. And then, you know, even the canned stuff, when I was growing up, even the canned stuff had some beef in it.
Yeah.
But it's vanished completely. Sometime in the last 20 years, I didn't notice exactly where.
Or at least preserved in suet or something, you know. But now it's just.
The suet has given way to cornstarch of all things.
Yeah.
Ugh, you know, you get this gluey, pasty thing.
Raisin cornstarch pie, right? Not that great.
I deplore the situation, however.
Well, there has been quite a bit of evolution in the Thanksgiving dinner, and we're going to talk about this and some more of the recipes when we come back after a short break.
You're listening to Favorite Flower by Pamela Royal on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by Rolling Press. Rolling Press is a family-run commercial offset print house that brings together environmentally friendly methods, ethical practices, and personalized service. Founded in 1998 by Eugene Lee and his father, Cam Lee, Rolling Press represents the harmony of traditional craftsmanship and green technology. Rolling Press prints using soy and vegetable inks, uses a variety of certified and recycled papers, and they incorporate a chemical-free production process. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
We are back on A Taste of the Past, talking with Sandy Oliver from her home in Maine. And I wanted to mention that Sandy's newest book is Maine Home Cooking, and we're going to get to some of those recipes and talking about that in a moment. Sandy, we were talking about some of the earlier recipes that might have been found on the Thanksgiving table, and even though a lot of the stories about plum pudding usually relate to Christmas, but plum pudding was something that was often found on a Thanksgiving table, was it not?
Yes, that's right.
Describe for our listeners.
That? Yeah. Well, that's another festival food, another one that was associated strongly with Christmas. But, you know, I'm going to ignore Christmas here in New England until the later 1800s. So we sort of slide our favorite old plum pudding and we plop it down on the Thanksgiving table.
And
there it is.
Describe
don't you, Linda, that plum pudding doesn't have plums in it?
Well, I know, but our listeners may not be aware of what plum pudding is.
Plum pudding is another one of these suet-laden rich things with lots and lots of raisins in it. It's sweet. It's a steamed pudding or a boiled pudding mixed with breadcrumbs and some sugar and lots of spices in it. Was very often boiled in a cloth. Comes out looking like a cannonball. Smells really good and is rich with lots of suet.
Yeah. Well, now, and understanding, too, that the hours of labor that it would take to make many of these things, because, remember, they were cooking over an open hearth. And keeping
that
fire
going. You know what it really is? I've cooked a lot on an open hearth, and I know possibly some of your listeners have too, and it's not the hearth so much, it's all that preparation. Let's just take one element of both mincemeat and plum pudding, and that is the raisins. In these early days, raisins came with the seeds still in them. They were a dried grape, which still had the seeds in it. And removing the seeds made the raisin more useful, preferable. Well, you can imagine what would happen if you had to sit down and pick the seeds out of every single dried grape you ever met.
I don't even want to go there.
You don't want to go there. I mean, we buy packages now, and it says seedless raisins on it. I think most people have never met a seeded raisin,
right,
one with seeds still in it. You can get them. You can get them, but
why?
Nobody wants those.
Right. Interesting.
So it's all that preparation. If you're going to get some suet, you have to slaughter a beef critter.
Well, and even finding suet is even a difficult thing to do sometimes in some markets,
true.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, and talk about commercialization. I mean, with the packaged raisins and pre-cooked Thanksgiving dinners. Commercialism has a big place in setting that date of Thanksgiving. There was an event that occurred. You want to tell us about Franksgiving?
I would. I just think that's such a riot. Sure, retailers began to notice in the middle of the 20th century that Thanksgiving marked the beginning of the Christmas holiday.
Black Friday,
shopping. Anyone?
Right.
Yeah. And, of course, nowadays we talk about Black Friday.
Right.
As early as 1939, retailers were lobbying Franklin Roosevelt to move the date of Thanksgiving back a little earlier in November. In 1939, Thanksgiving was going to fall on November 30th. And they thought, oh, that's really late. Maybe we can get him to move it back up 1 week and extend the holiday shopping period by 1 week. And he did. He did do that. And lots of people just howled and complained and, that it didn't go off very well. So we finally settled on the current day, that same, it's the fourth Thursday of November.
Right.
That's the settled date.
Well, and they laughed at him and called, they actually scathing reviews and called it Franksgiving rather than Thanksgiving.
That's right.
Shows his own date. Right.
Now, this whole holiday shopping thing, we don't have much of a good perspective on that, but I have read newspaper articles from the mid-1800s where, the newspaper editors were deploring the commercialization of holidays, saying such thing as, for heaven's sakes, people are Christmas shopping as early as December 15th. You haven't seen anything yet.
Well, as long as everyone does still stop and take that break for one day of thanks on Thanksgiving, I think that's you know, we can abide by all of these early shopping days. Some of the early dishes, I mean, I know we all realize that Thanksgiving dishes and menus have changed dramatically over the years. But even some of the Thanksgiving dinners in the early 1900s would have found many different dishes. I mean, in many parts of the country, oysters still do make an appearance, but oysters were a major part of Thanksgiving dinners, were they not?
Yeah, that's right. Sure, that's the starter course. A nice oyster soup or oyster stew to start.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing better. Lovely way to start a meal. Yeah.
And put some in your stuffing, too. That's good.
Yes, yes. Good for that, too. Yeah. I think when I look at early stuffing recipes, I think I see a little more variability than I do nowadays. And nowadays, you know, I think an awful lot of our stuffings are driven by what's convenient to get from a package. And people like that, and that's fine. But, you know, there were a lot more wrinkles on stuffing in the past that, you know, people could enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think as long as people, what I love is how immigrants have taken to America, have taken this to be one of their favorite holidays as well, and they celebrate with a passion and an abandon. And I love how they bring many of their own dishes from their own countries into the celebration as well.
That's right. They did what the first settlers did. They, you know, they recognized that this is a festival, so out comes all the festival food.
Right.
Whatever your culture is that calls for festival food, then you do the festival food of that culture.
Right. So no one.
And then you tuck in a few of the American things as well. There is one side of Thanksgiving that's a little bit, I'm not quite sure how to term it, but you know, it was a bit of a tool to manipulate immigrants into acting like Americans. It was sort of a propaganda, if you will.
Melting pot, the melting pot actually had a bad connotation in that regard.
Yes, it did. Yeah, that's right. You know, it was sort of, well, if you really were a good American, if you were an honest to goodness American, you'd eat turkey on Thanksgiving. And kids picked this message up at school. Took it home, and I have a feeling that there were some mothers out there who came from wonderful cooking traditions like Italian ones or even some of the other European traditions and thought, you know, if we have perfectly good festive dishes, why do we have to have this turkey on the table?
Right, right.
But that was it, you know, that's what Americans did, so, oh, all right, we'll have a turkey on the table. And that's still true, even though, you know, some of the cultures that have come to this country in more recent times are not accustomed to having one massive hunk of meat on the table under any circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My co-author, Kathleen, talked about a group of people in Boston who got together for Thanksgiving, and they drew pieces of paper that said what they would be bringing to the feast. And a Jamaican woman got the turkey. And so she went to the market, she bought the turkey, and she instructed the butcher to cut it up. Lots of pieces. And when Kathleen told me that, I went,
And you know, it probably...
I'm so used to this big piece of meat on the table, this whole bird presentation. But she had this perfectly lovely Jamaican dish that she made out of whacked up turkey. She brought that to the dinner.
And it probably cooked very evenly and tasted wonderful.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
sure. Well, let's talk about some of the dishes that might be found on a Maine table with your new book, Maine Home Cooking. Do you have any particular festive dishes in there that would be used to celebrate Thanksgiving?
Well, you know, okay. We do the Yankee thing up here, you know, unless you're a very sophisticated person, read the New York Times or the Boston Globe, or, you know, get subscribed to Sever or America's Cooks Illustrated or one of those. Chances are what you're going to have is a turkey with some bread stuffing. We don't do cornbread stuffing very much in the North. You're going to have mashed potatoes with gravy. You might have turnips or squash or squash. You probably would have sweet potatoes. The grocery stores are full of sweet potatoes. I hate to say how many people like to put marshmallows on those. I think there are still a few diehards around here that like to have creamed onions. And then, you know, rolls to go with it. And that green bean casserole, which has become the new standard of the last half century or so. Followed by at least apple pie and pumpkin pie, if not a mincemeat pie. A fair number of Maine families, especially the rural ones with a hunting tradition and a hunter in the family, still make mincemeat using deer meat. It's, the neck is particularly desirable for deer for making mincemeat. Though you can certainly use other parts as well. So there's still some people out there eating traditional mincemeat, and that'll appear in a pie on the table as well.
Do you have a recipe for mincemeat, traditional mincemeat, in your new book?
No, I don't.
Oh, no.
Oh, you'll have to get Giving Thanks for the traditional mincemeat.
That's
the
right.
Traditional mincemeat. In Giving Thanks.
And I just, I wanted to, you've mentioned Kathleen a couple times, and I forgot to mention her name. Sandy is the author, along with Kathleen Curtin, of Giving Thanks. And Plymouth Plantation, this was, you were doing some work with them. Kathleen was a food historian for Plymouth Plantation, was she not?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Kathleen and I were good friends and colleagues. And when she had, in my very first book, Saltwater Foodways, I dedicated a whole chapter to the history of Thanksgiving in New England. And she, having represented Plymouth Plantation in the 17th century, what happened in the 1620s, for a really long time, didn't feel like she had as firm a handle on the Victorian Thanksgiving as I did. So when Plymouth Plantation proposed this book, she got in touch with me. And I took care of the 18th century and the 19th century. She did the 17th and 20th centuries. We had such a fine time writing that book. It's really a peach of a book.
It is. It's wonderful, not only just as a terrific information and reference book, but the recipes are wonderful. I have to say, you did a really great job with the recipes as well.
And the recipes are fabulous.
I can't wait to read the recipes in your newest book, Maine Home Cooking. Sandy, it's been a pleasure. I'm so happy you were able to join me today, and I look forward to hearing more about what might be on your Thanksgiving table this year. Thank you for listening. I'm Linda Palacio, host of A Taste of the Past, here on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.